Good morning.
Good morning.
Our lesson comes from that reading. There was a line in that reading you may have caught. The New King James says, "Our soul loathes this worthless bread." Did you hear that? That line in that? The New American Standard has changed over the years, but I think the latest version or one of the versions of the New American Standard says, we are disgusted with this miserable food. And that's our title this morning, this miserable food. And what's the point of this? It's about people being not content with God's provision. And that's really what I want to talk with you about this morning, not being content with God's provision. Let's take a moment to see where we are as the Israelites journey through the wilderness. We know that this story takes place when they're being bitten by serpents, and then Moses builds a bronze serpent, puts it on the pole, and if they look to that, they'll be saved from the death that was resulting from the serpent bites. Where does this story take place? When does this take place? It's during the 40 years in the wilderness. Let's take a look at a map here. Mount Hor is mentioned in connection with this context. Mount Hor, there are a couple of possible locations for Mount Hor. One peak that may have been the ancient Mount Hor is here. And this seems likely because if you look at this map, it's on the western border of Edom. And if we go to Deuteronomy, the 20th chapter, the chapter just before this, you'll notice in verse 23, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom. And of course, what he says is here, Aaron's going to die. He goes up on Mount Hor and he dies. This is when, and remember that. We're going to come back to that in a moment. So, on the border of Edom, this location for Mount Hor seems to fit it. There's another location, though, more to the north and northwest. Mount Hor may have been a peak up this direction. And apparently, we're just really not sure. But what we do know is that after Aaron dies on Mount Hor, then we have this passage in Numbers chapter 21, verse 4, talking about the people setting out from Mount Hor. And then we have the story with the miserable food and the serpents and the bronze serpent. And then after that, we find that the people come to a place called Oboth. If you come down to chapter 21 and verse 10, "Now the sons of Israel moved out and camped in Oboth. And they journeyed from Oboth and camped at Iabarim in the wilderness, which is opposite Moab to the east." So they make some progress from Oboth. What they do is they're going to head down to the south toward the Red Sea and then come up around the east side of Edom. They're going to go around Edom in this manner. Come up on the east side of the Jordan Valley, and then eventually, of course, they will cross the Jordan and go into the Promised Land. So what we know then is this story involving the miserable food, as they called it, and the bronze serpent takes place between the time they left Mount Hor and came to Oboth. So we don't know which mountain. If it was this mountain down to the south, then they would have had to backtrack to Oboth before heading south. If it were the one to the north, then they would have come from there to Oboth. Either way, it's on that section there, that in that time between Mount Hor and Oboth, where this story takes place, and then they make this southerly circuit around Edom and come up the east side. So that's the context. And then we have this passage in Numbers chapter 21 and verse 4, where it introduces this problem. They set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. So the people spoke against God and Moses, "Why have you brought us up from Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we are disgusted with this miserable food." So what was the miserable food? Well, we know what God was providing them for food during this 40 years, the manna. If we go back to Exodus chapter 16 and verse 35, the sons of Israel ate the manna for 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. This was God's provision for them that they're calling this miserable food. And apparently it was actually pretty good stuff. We have a description of it in verse 31 of Exodus 16. "The house of Israel named the bread manna, and it was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like wafers and honey." That sounds pretty good. And I don't know if anybody else thinks this, but I always think of vanilla wafers. So I always picture the Israelites out there and is going out and gathering baskets full of vanilla wafers. And I like vanilla wafers. So God's provision, it was good. God was generously providing for the Israelites during this period of time. In Deuteronomy 29, words that are spoken a little bit after the time that we're studying right here, just before they're going to go into the land of Canaan. God says, I have led you in the wilderness for 40 years. Your clothes have not worn out on you, and your sandal has not worn out on your foot. God was taking care of them. Later on, we'll see manna was part of this overall description of God's provision for them in Nehemiah, the 9th chapter. This is much later in history when the people led by the Levites are acknowledging their sin, and they're reflecting upon the fact that God indeed had provided for them. And so we have this passage in Nehemiah 9 where they address God and they say, you in your great compassion did not abandon them in the wilderness, talking about their forefathers. The pillar of cloud did not leave them by day to guide them on their way, nor the pillar of fire by night to light for them the way in which they were to go. Instead, you gave your good spirit to instruct them, and you did not withhold your manna from their mouth. And you gave them water for their thirst. Indeed, for 40 years you provided for them in the wilderness, and they were not lacking. Their clothes did not wear out, nor did their feet swell up. Apparently, God miraculously kept their clothes from wearing out and kept their sandals in good shape. And they're doing all that walking, and their feet did not swell up. But they were not content with God's provision. Just think about that. Everything God is doing for them. Brought them out of slavery, on the way to a promised land, giving them everything they need, but they're not content. We are disgusted with this miserable food. I get it. They've been in the wilderness a long time. Even if I like vanilla wafers, if I had vanilla wafers every day and that was my food, I might get tired of it. We like variety. When Libby and I were young and newly married for the first year of our marriage, before she had developed a greater repertoire in her cooking abilities and become the wonderful cook that she is now. And when we were trying to save money, actually, it wasn't so much trying to save money as we were trying to just get by on what little money we had. We didn't have much at all, and I wasn't making a lot. And so we had, I don't know, she may tell you it wasn't exactly like that. It seems to me we had tuna and noodles every night for a year. And I got so tired of tuna and noodles. It was a long time after that. We knew that we would get to a point where we could have something beside tuna and noodles. But when we quit having tuna and noodles, it was a long time before the thought ever crossed my mind that, I would like some tuna and noodles. And actually, just in the last week or two, the thought did cross my mind. I thought, you know, I might like some tuna and noodles, but I don't want them every night for the next year. We get tired of things. But there was a reason. There was a reason we were doing that. And we had a vision of a future and a purpose. And there was a reason that God brought the Israelites through what he brought them. And he let them be hungry. And he tested them that they would know that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. They would depend upon him for all things. And moreover, the fact is, they were almost to the end of their journey when they're complaining about this miserable food. And they knew they were almost to the end of the journey. God had told them it would be 40 years. Well, where are we in this history of 40 years when they're complaining about this miserable food? In Numbers chapter 20, we mentioned this, at Mount Hor, that's where Aaron dies. We know that not because it tells us we do know that he died at Mount Hor in Numbers 20, but we find out what year it was later on. In Numbers 33, there's a list of the places that the Israelites journeyed. And in chapter 33 and verse 38, it says, then Aaron the priest went up to Mount Hor at the command of the Lord and died there in the what year? In the 40th year, after the sons of Israel had come from the land of Egypt, on the first day in the fifth month. So they've completed 4 months into the 40th year when Aaron dies. And then we have the story about complaining about this miserable food. So Aaron dies in the 40th year, first day of the fifth month, and then we come to Numbers chapter 21, verses 4 through 9, and they're complaining about the miserable food. They only had 8 months to go before they get to the promised land. Now, I get it. I don't want to eat tuna noodles or vanilla wafers for the next 8 months if that's all I have. I like a little variety. But God is taking them to a glorious future. He's got something wonderful in mind for them. And they know when it's going to be. They know that's coming. And they're not content with God's provision. It reminds me of the story of Eve in the Garden of Eden. And I find myself amazed at how often I keep going back to the story of the first sin. Because the story of the first sin is in many ways the story of all of our sin. You remember that she looked at the food and saw that it was good for food, and it was a delight to the eyes and desirable to make one wise. And so you have the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. All of our basic motivations that lie behind our sin. And in that story, we also see two people. One is deceived and one is not deceived. And, well, there you go. Some people today sin. They're deceived and some are not deceived. But you also see what? You also see somebody who is not content with God's provision. Remember what God had said. The Lord commanded in chapter 3, verse 16. This is actually chapter 2 and verse 16. The Lord commanded the man, saying, from any tree of the garden you may freely eat. If we go back to chapter 1, God had explicitly told them, every seed-bearing plant, every seed-bearing tree, it's for you. There it is for you. God had put them in a paradise, everything that they need, and abundantly bless them with food. You can eat any of it. There's one tree. Just don't eat from that tree. You can eat everything else. God had generously provided for them, and Eve was not content. She chose to eat from the one tree God said don't eat from. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5 kind of brings this message home to us, to be content with God's provision. I'm starting in the middle of the verse here. I'm going to come back and get the end of the beginning of this verse in a moment, but you'll see the three dots there. So we're starting in the middle of the verse. And it just says, being content with what you have. Now, we'll come back to this passage in just a second, but let's jump back to that Nehemiah passage. In Nehemiah 9, verse 19, when they were reflecting upon God's provision for them all the way back in the wilderness, he says, they say to God, you in your great compassion did not abandon them in the wilderness. Watch what the Hebrew writer does in verse 5. He says, being content with what you have, for he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever abandon you. Now, he's not quoting Nehemiah. In fact, he's quoting Deuteronomy 31, verse 6, which says something similar. But the point of this is to say the same God who provided for them in the wilderness and who did not abandon them provides for us today and will not abandon us. So when we look at them and we see them not being content with what God provided for them, there's a lesson for us. We have a God who's giving us what we need. What does it say about our faith in him when we are not content with what he gives us? In 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 6, Paul says, godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering with these, we shall be content. Let's talk about some applications of this. Let's talk about wealth for just a moment. This is one of the areas where sometimes we find ourselves not being content, maybe with our financial station in life. Back to that passage in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5, where it said, being content with what you have, for he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever abandon you. Let's fill in those three dots at the beginning of the verse. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. we need to be content. Not look around us and say, well, I don't have as much money as they do. I don't have as many nice things. 1 Timothy chapter 6, going back to this passage, if we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. That passage continues, and it says, but those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. People do. People get led astray from the things of God. They get led astray when they get focused on the things of this world, materialistic focus. It's a danger we need to watch out for. Now, there is Philippians chapter 4. Paul says, not that I speak from need, for I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with little, and I also know how to live in prosperity. And I think I quote this most of all to talk about being content if I'm getting along with little. Maybe we don't pay enough attention to the fact that he also says he knew how to live in prosperity. There's nothing wrong with being prosperous. And the reality is, in our world, if you are honest and you are diligent and you are reliable, you show up, you do what you're called on to do, all of those things are things that ought to characterize Christians. And if you are nice to people, that should characterize Christians. And you can get along with people because you're nice to people, that should characterize Christians. Chances are you're going to do well. Chances are you're going to get promotions. You're going to get pay increases. We can hit hard times, sure. We can lose jobs, sure. But chances are you will do well. And if we do well, we don't need to feel bad about the fact that we are doing well. Paul wrote in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17 about those who are rich in this present world. And he talked to Timothy about what to say to them. And it wasn't, hey, feel guilty that you've acquired some means. Here's what he said. Charge them that are rich in this present world that they be not high-minded, nor have their hope set on the uncertainty of riches, but on God. So their focus needs to be on God. Can't be on the things. Who gives us richly all things to enjoy. This is God's provision. That they do good. So here's what you charge them. To do good, that they be rich in good works. And this is the American Standard. It says that they be willing to communicate. Do I have this on screen? No, I don't have it on screen. That they be willing to communicate, which means to share. And then it says, laying up for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on the life which is life indeed. In other words, their focus does not need to be on the things of this world. It needs to be on the life to come, and they need to use what they have in this time in the way God wills, that is, being generous and willing to share. And that's really the key. If I find myself focused on the things of this world to the extent that I am sacrificing God's things, that is to say, I am prioritizing the things of the world, the material things. If I find myself prioritizing those things over the things of God, you know what that is? There's a word for it in the Bible. It's covetousness. It's covetousness. Another translation, some of the modern translations are going to use the word greed. And in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, Paul just says it's idolatry. Covetousness, greed, it's idolatry. Because now this is my God. This is what controls me. So if I find myself not content with my financial status, and I start making choices that prioritize material things over spiritual things, I'm not content with God's provision. I'm like those Israelites back in the wilderness. But I have a couple of other applications I want to talk about this morning. I want to talk about the wife of my youth. Proverbs 5, verse 18 says, rejoice in the wife of your youth. The way he words it, it sounds like he's writing to a man who's been married for a while. This is addressed to a man who's been married for a while. And maybe he's not so young anymore, and maybe his wife is not so young anymore. rejoice in the wife of your youth. But what happens? Sometimes a man decides he's not content with God's provision. And he starts looking for somebody else, or he just meets somebody else. And he has an affair. Or maybe he actually divorces his wife to chase this younger woman. Why do men do that? Maybe he is reaching for some distant, youthful, vigorous past when he was young. He's trying to recapture that. Maybe he's trying to grab something that he imagines, which he never had, but he wants it. But whatever it is, which direction is he looking? He's not looking ahead to that eternal glory that God has in mind for us. He's looking backwards. And he's trying to grab hold of something now, and he's not content with what God has provided. In Malachi chapter 2 and verse 14, the Lord has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously. Though she is your marriage companion and your wife by covenant, when we enter into marriage, we enter into a covenant with our spouse before God. And this is something God has provided us, and it's a great blessing. And we get to a point where I'm not content with this blessing. I have in mind something else. We're making the mistake of the Israelites. And who is somebody in the Bible, somebody in the Old Testament, who did this very thing? Think about David. It's interesting, in 2 Samuel 12, the point that the Lord makes through Nathan the prophet to David is the very point I'm trying to stress this morning. God had provided generously for David, and David was not content with it. In 2 Samuel 12, verse 7, the Lord says through Nathan the prophet to David, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you, and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you all Israel and Judah. And if all this had been too little, I would have given you more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes?" God is saying, "I've given you everything, and you weren't satisfied. You chose something else and despised the word of the Lord." With this in mind, I want you to think with me a little bit this morning about the problem of pornography. I don't know, I might say pornography is the sin of our time. It is such a prevalent sin. Even among people who are professing to be God's people, it is a prevalent problem. And we need to think about it and understand there are a lot of things that are wrong with pornography. It's destructive in so many ways. Just in the last couple of months, I've become aware, I think it's three different families who are being torn up by pornography. It disrupts marriages. It leads to dishonesty. It's addictive. It is a great danger. But one of the things that's wrong with it is a man is not being content with God's provision. I know it can be a problem for women too, but mostly what I see is it's a problem for men. I think that's typically true in our culture. And you think about a man, a married man, and it's obvious if you've got a married man and he's turning to pornography, he is not content with what God has provided him. Maybe he says, "Well, I don't think the relationship that I have with my wife is what I want it to be, or even what it should be." Do you imagine the Israelites in the wilderness? They were kind of thinking, "I don't think this is what we want or what things should be." And yet, God was providing for them, and they just needed to put their trust in God's provision. Or maybe you have a single man, and he's not been married, and he can't find anybody who will marry him. Well, if that's the case, he may need to work on himself a little bit. But maybe time goes by, and he's getting a little frustrated, And he said, well, I'm a single man. You know, what am I going to do? It's been a long time. The Israelites were in the wilderness for 40 years. 40 years. What God gave them was what they needed. God knows what we need. He's given us what we need. He has reserved the sexual relationship for marriage. Apparently, God believes that we have what we need. And if somebody is single and they decide, well, you know, that's my excuse, they're not content with what God has provided. If I'm not content with what God provides in this life, if I go through this lifetime and I just wasn't good enough, what God gave me, it just wasn't good enough. When I get to the day of judgment, do you think God is going to give me eternal life? Do you think God is going to give me that reward of a heavenly home if everything he's provided in this life, I decided that wasn't good enough for me, it wasn't enough, that he's going to then say, well, how about this? God's eternal reward is for those who put their trust in him. And if I'm not content with what God provides me, I'm not putting my trust in him. Well, so what's the solution? Let's go back to Numbers chapter 21. When the Israelites complained about this miserable food and they were not content with what God was giving them, what happened? God sent serpents. They experienced some consequences. They were dying from the serpent bites. They complained. They turned to Moses. They said, intercede on our behalf with God. Moses does so. God says, build a bronze serpent and set it up in the camp. And if everybody, whoever gets bitten, if they'll look at that serpent, then they'll live. What was that all about? It's not just a random story in the Old Testament. It's one of these stories that's about Jesus. In John, have I got it on screen? John, the third chapter in verse 14, Jesus says, just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, so that everyone who believes will have eternal life in him. Jesus is making the parallel, the connection. That bronze serpent back there in the wilderness represents Jesus being lifted up on the cross. And what's the similarities? If you think about it, they were being bitten by serpents that were causing them death. We are being bitten by sin that causes our death. They could be saved from that death if they looked at something that looked like what was bringing death to them. We can be saved from our death if we look at our sin in the body of Christ on the cross. Our sin being punished in the sacrifice of Jesus. And we can be saved from our death, from the death from our sin. So you see the parallel here. So what's the point? They looked to the bronze serpent, which represents Jesus. We look to Jesus. If we will look to Jesus instead of to right here and now and what I want right here and now, how do we do that? In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, the writer says, therefore, since we also have such a great cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let's rid ourselves of every obstacle and the sin which so easily entangles us. And let's run with endurance the race that is set before us. You know, when you're running a race, there are times in the race when you don't feel very content. I don't feel very good. We're running a race. But what do you do in that race? You focus on the goal. And that's what it says Jesus did. We're supposed to look to Jesus in verse 2. Looking only at Jesus, the originator and perfecter of the faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross. Jesus looked at the joy that was set before him and went through the cross. And the writer of Hebrews is saying, you do that. You look to Jesus and follow his example. Look to the glory that's to be revealed. It's like when we're talking about wealth and being content with what we have. Even if we have wealth, even if we've done well, we need to be looking to what God has in store for us and using our wealth accordingly in the here and now. It can't be about the here and now. Looking only to Jesus, the originator and perfecter of the faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So, parents, if you are putting rules in place for your children, limiting their access to the internet, don't feel bad about that. That's a good thing to do. If you're putting rules in place saying you're not going to have a smartphone until you're such and such an age or until you've demonstrated that you're going to use this properly and within the guidelines that I give you as a parent, within the guidelines that are ultimately from God, then at that point you can have a smartphone. If all their friends are getting smartphones and all their friends have access to the internet and you're limiting your children, do it. Because you are saving them from a temptation that is just endemic, epidemic. It's a problem in this world right now. And it'll distract them from that future reward. So many things about pornography, so many things, the destructive nature of pornography as far as a man's ability to have a real relationship with a real woman, the destructive results of pornography if a man is already married to his relationship with his wife, the addictive nature of it. Turn away from it. Focus on Jesus. Focus on the eternal glory. Be content with God's provision, knowing that God made us. He knows what we need. He knows what's good for us, and pornography isn't it. So parents, I'm going to just amen you if you're putting restrictions in place for your kids. Do it. We're going to sing a song in just a moment, and the song is Send the Light. And so, you know, we can get focused on talking about sending the light, and sometimes when I was growing up, I always heard Send the Light sung, not always, but often in connection with comments about the preachers we support. Or we'd be sending a preacher, maybe Dad would be going off to preach somewhere, and we'd sing Send the Light. And we'd focus, yes, we're sending the light. In view of our study this morning, our lesson this morning, what I'd like you to think about is, you know, if I want to be effective in sending the light, I need to be the light. I need to be the light in the way I conduct my life. And it's not going to do me a whole lot of good, and ultimately, it's going to be a stumbling block to those I'm trying to send the light to if I demonstrate myself to be discontent with what God has provided me. Let's stand and sing the song, Send the Light.